Again, Kian felt a push at his mind, more subtle than the last, yet much more forceful. He shoved back, much more forcefully as well, and this time the man's unusual eyes flickered the tiniest bit.
"You don't mean what I think you mean by that," said Dagus.
"Thinking implies sentience. I see little of that in you."
"Look in a mirror, you'll see even less.
I'll have your clan name, Highlander. What is it?"
Jessica piped up. "Speaking of looking in a mirror..."
"You'll have my clan name and a battle. 'Tis Keltar,"
Kian spat.
"And yours?" "Keltar,"
Dagus spat back. Kian stared at him, stunned. Beside him, Jessica exclaimed,
"I knew it! I knew it! That's what I was trying to tell you, Kian! That the two of you look alike!"
Chapter 18.
"Get back here! You can't be finding out that you're my kinsman and then just go stomping off!"
Dagus snapped at Kian's broad retreating back.
"Watch me!"
the towering barbarian flung over his shoulder. To the dazed salesman he ordered,
"Pack it all up and load it in a black SUV outside the door. Here are the keys. Lock it when you've finished. I'll return for it anon. You will not speak of me or my woman to anyone."
Bending an arm around the curvaceous, raven-haired woman's shoulder, he steered her toward the door.
"We have much yet to do. Come, lass."
Dagus watched in disbelief as his ancestor, Kian McKelter. He was assuming it had to be the 9th century Kian McKelter standing before him, for he'd ne'er heard of any other Keltar with that name. Prepared to stalk off into the Highland morn without so much as a fare thee well, without even having offered a good morrow, kinsman, for that matter, without so much as a blethering word of clanly tidings, without a single explanation for this incomprehensible happenstance. Furthermore, the man was indiscriminately using voice left and right, as if no rules applied to him whatsoever.
"I assume you'll be paying for those goods,"
Dagus said pointedly.
"You assume wrong."
With that, the massive, wild-looking, tattooed Highlander guided the woman out the door, the salesman close on their heels. Dagus glowered at the closing door. Christ, his ancestor was a savage. No wonder he'd gotten such a bad name. He looked uncontrollable, and he behaved like a barbarian. And, by Danu, the power he sensed in him. Raw, rich, potent magic flowed through the man's veins, not blood. If the Dragaar had gotten their claws into Kian rather than him... He blew out a long, deep breath. 'Twas a damn good thing they hadn't. Though he couldn't fathom for a moment what might have prevented such a primitive, egotistical beast from breaking any rule he damn well pleased, including using the standing stones of Ban Drocade for his own purposes. What was he doing here? How had he gotten here? Where had he been for the past 11 centuries? Who was the woman with him? He'd tried probing her while she'd stood at Kian's side, but had encountered some kind of sleek, smooth barrier. Was she a practitioner of magics, too? His deep listening talents had been growing by leaps and bounds over the past few months, and he should have been able to pick up something, but he'd not gotten a flicker of a thought or emotion from her.
"Thurston's not going to like this," he muttered darkly. "Nay, he's not going to like it at all."
If a willingness to sacrifice everything for those he loved characterized Dagus, an abiding, unrelenting honor, and a desire for a simple life uncomplicated by matters of druidry and the fey, characterized his elder twin, Druston. When he heard tell of this latest news, Druston would undoubtedly say,
"Why the blethren hell can't people stay where they belong, in their own century and out of mine?"
At which point his wife, Gwyn, would remind him that it wasn't his century, that in fact it was he who'd begun it all by refusing to stay in the 16th century where he belonged. That if Druston hadn't opted to slumber for 500 years in a realm enchantment so he could be reunited with Gwyn in the 21st century, he never would have died in the fire that night so long ago. And if he'd not died in the fire, Dagus wouldn't have had to breach Keltar oaths and use the standing stones of the Ban Drocade in violation of the sacred compact, between man and the Tuatha De Dona for personal gain, to go back in time and save Drustin's life. And if Dagus hadn't breached those oaths, he never would have been possessed by the souls of the 13 evil Dragaar, and forced to come forward himself to the 21st century, seeking a way to escape them. And by the time his brainy physicist sister-in-law was done, Dagus had no doubt she'd have found some way to postulate an obscure, yet peculiarly synchronistic link between Dagus and Kian himself, and Drustin would heap the blame for this new visitor soundly at Dagus's feet. Which was beyond far-fetched. There was no way he was taking the blame for the sudden appearance of their controversial ninth-century ancestor. He'd only been reading up on him, not trying to summon him. He rubbed his jaw, frowning, wishing he could be entirely certain of that last fact. The problem was, months ago in London, when Avil, queen of the Tuatha De Dona, had personally appeared and wielded her immense power to strip away the souls of the 13 evil druids possessing him, freeing him from their dark control. She'd left their memories inside him, and he wasn't always certain of precisely what he was capable or not. Initially, when the queen had removed the 13 souls of the Dragaar from him, he'd believed himself entirely free. After suffering the din of 13 rapacious, twisted, demanding entities inside him, the silence inside his skull had made him think them completely eradicated. It had been some time before he'd realized that, although their consciousnesses were gone, every last memory of the 13 entire lives had been left in him, buried deep in his subconscious. He'd not wanted to believe that he still contained the terrible and forbidden lore the Dragaar had so long ago amassed, and at first, when inexplicable knowledge had begun popping into his head, he denied it. But he no longer could. Each day he discovered something new about himself, and on occasion of late, he'd caught himself muttering bits of a spell beneath his breath that he'd never read or practiced, and he knew he'd somehow plucked it from the endless vaults of the Dragaar within him, as if his subconscious were sorting through the banks of memories, filing them away according to some mysterious design. Had he inadvertently used a spell? He sighed. If he had, this was his fault, and he had to fix it. If he hadn't, he still had to do something. He couldn't just let the oversized heathen stalk and stomp about their highlands, using voice on all and sundry, stealing goods from simple merchants honestly endeavoring to support their clansmen. "As if you've never stolen anything," his conscience jabbed. "Aye, but I always gave it back eventually." And he had. He didn't think Kian McKelter had any intention of making eventual amends. He didn't look like an eventual amends kind of man. Sighing, he tucked the box containing Chloe's hiking boots beneath his arm and walked out the door after his ninth-century ancestor. As he stepped into the sunny Highland morn, he looked left, then right. He spied neither hide nor hair of Kian McKelter. Back at the castle, his 4.5 months pregnant wife awaited him. Pregnancy suited his lovely Chloe like a Highlander's wet dream. She was even more amorous of late, and she was quite the sensual vixen under the usual circumstances. He was of no mind to be separated from her for long. They'd planned a hike in the hills today, and a leisurely picnic. It was warm enough to toop outside on a plaid beneath an endless blue sky, and he'd been greatly anticipating hours and hours of hedonistic love play. Her breasts were getting fuller. Her hips widening, and her skin glowed with the inner radiance of impending motherhood. He was impatient to taste and touch and explore every last changing inch of her. He was of no mind to alter his plans to accommodate this recent unexpected development. Highly unexpected development at that.
"Drustin, remember our ancestor Kian, who I was talking about recently? Well, he's here."
He shook his head, muttering a string of curses. He thought for a moment, absently watching the still fully compelled salesman. That was a serious wallop his ancestor's voice packed. Load the stolen goods into Kian's SUV, wondering how he might spend the most time with Chloe yet still manage this new wrinkle. His eyes narrowed. Camping gear. His kinsman was purloining camping gear.
Was he squatting somewhere on Keltar land? The gall! How long had he been there? He angled around the store employee and peered deeper into the SUV. He blinked. Then he blinked again, very slowly, keeping his eyes closed for a moment before opening them. It was still there. It couldn't be. By Amergen, 'twasn't possible. Was it?
Move!
He growled at the salesman, employing voice without even thinking about it. The salesman stepped obediently aside. Dagus reached into the SUV, pushed aside the blanket half concealing the object, and another string of curses spilled from his lips.
Impossible!
But the proof of it was right there before his very eyes. He'd never seen it before. Verily, he never thought to see it. But the Dragaar had. The dark glass. One of four unholy, unseelie hallows. At one point, the glass had actually been in their possession. They'd never been able to translate the spells necessary to use it, though not for lack of trying. Nor had they ever discerned its purpose. It was a mystery to him as well. But he knew all he needed to know. His legendary ancestor of allegedly epic moral turpitude had one of the forbidden unseelie hallows in his possession. And he was alive. And here in present day. What the blethering hell was a Keltar druid doing with the blackest of black magics? They were seelie guardians, not unseelie. The situation was far grimmer than he'd thought. Rubbing his jaw, he pondered his options. They were few. He'd felt the power in his ancestor. He didn't delude himself for a moment that he'd be able to subdue him with magic, unless he called on some of the Dragaar's tricks, a thing he was highly reluctant to do. Nor could he hope to use brute force without the possibility of innocent bystanders getting caught in the fray, especially not if the formidable druid simply lashed out with a spell to stop him. Yet he needed to get the man to Castle Keltar. Once there, mayhap together he and Drustin could bind him, question him, discover what was going on, and what to do about it. His gaze slid back to the dark glass. It exerted an unpleasant pull on him, made him hunger to touch it. He'd heard tell that the dark hallows tended to have such a dangerous effect on men with power in their veins. He'd never experienced it before, and hoped not to again. He felt both a constant, irresistible urge to reach for it, and also a bone-deep chill warning him away. Eyeing it warily, the simplest solution occurred to him, one that would keep his need to touch it to a minimum. His ancestor wasn't the only one who could use voice. Dagus excelled at it, too, though he doubted he could outright contradict anything his ancestor had commanded. He was fair certain he could work around it. Placing a hand on the salesman's shoulder, he instructed him quietly but forcefully.
You will give me the keys to that SUV, and when he returns for his vehicle, you will tell him he will find it here.
Plucking a pen and one of the young salesman's business cards from the pocket of the glassy-eyed man's crisp white shirt, he scribbled the address of Castle Keltar.
You will give him these keys, and direct him to that vehicle.
Handing the salesman his own set of keys, he pointed down the street to the vehicle he'd recently purchased. A Hummer, it was called, though in his estimation it leaned more toward a roar than a hum. The salesman nodded blankly. Dagus had no doubt his ancestor would come, sword swinging to reclaim the dark glass. The man was fiercely aggressive by nature, and given that he was freely dabbling with black arts, he would be even more so. Like as not, he'd be dangerously violent. He and Drustin would be wise to sequester Chloe, Gwyn, and the young twins away. Carefully, without making contact with the glass, he rearranged the blanket over the mirror. Then, circling round to the driver's side of the SUV, Dagus tossed Chloe's boots onto the passenger seat, climbed in, fired up the engine, and headed for home.
"But he's your descendant, for heaven's sake!" Jessie exclaimed. "How can you just walk away from him?"
The moment she'd seen the man, Dagus, scowling at Kian, she'd been struck by their sameness. The more she'd stared back and forth between them, the more convinced she'd become that they had to be related somehow.
Though Kian's descendant had been dressed in expensive, tailored black trousers, a black turtleneck, and a buttery, soft leather jacket, though he'd been well-groomed and polished, his civilized appearance had failed to conceal an innate primitiveness that was just like Kian's. She'd tried to point it out, but they were kindred even in their edgy tempers and excess testosterone. She'd not been able to spit the whole sentence out because they'd kept talking over her. She'd continued her assessment, periodically attempting to interject her thoughts, to no avail. Both had long, dark hair. Both had strong, chiseled Celtic features. Both had arrogance shaping the very curve of their spine, conquest in the cant of their heads upon their shoulders, and an extra something running in their veins besides very blue, very pure blood. Both had a base, seething sexuality. Both had powerful, highly developed physiques, and there was no denying it, Dagus was incredible looking. But Kian was more man than his descendant, raw, more elemental. Dagus was leaner and prettier. Kian was larger, rough, tough, down and dirty, and hands down sexier.
"Hey, wait for me,"
she called, sprinting to catch up with him. While she'd been mulling over her thoughts, he'd stalked off again. He was disappearing from her view down the sugar, spice, dry goods aisle. For a man from the 9th century, he was a quick study. Upon entering the grocery store, he'd eyed a cart consideringly, glanced around at other customers, snatched it, and begun pushing up and down aisles, examining items, selecting various cans and tins, tossing them in. Instant Swiss mocha. Woo-hoo! Jessie took 2 tins of it from the shelf as she sped by, caught up with him, and dumped them in the cart. She'd not missed the gas stove and pots he'd heisted, and was greatly looking forward to a cup of chocolatey coffee once they got back to their camp.
"Aren't you the least little bit curious about him?" she pressed.
He grunted.
"Now is not the time for new beginnings, lass."
He cast the words over his shoulder at her with a scowl.
"I'll make none."
Though she tried to hide it, a flicker of hurt flashed across her face. No new beginnings. She knew that. And it shouldn't bother her. It wasn't as if they were making a new beginning or anything like that. They were just stuck with each other for a while. He wanted sex from her, nothing more. And this morning, he'd not even wanted sex. She was merely his means of remaining free from Lucan until he could have his vengeance. And he was merely her means of staying alive. He couldn't have made his feelings any plainer, really. Since the airport, all she'd gotten in the way of a kiss had been a stupid peck on the forehead that a chicken could have done better. But, like an idiot, she'd begun reading more into things than was actually there. They were forced to share close quarters. There was danger, and it was just making everything feel more intense than it was. On top of it, the man was devastatingly sexy, powerful, smart, and magic to boot. Who could blame a girl? No new beginnings. Damn it, it shouldn't bother her. But it did. She tried to turn away, but his hand flashed out and caught her by the chin.
"Let me go,"
she snapped.
"Nay."
His grip was implacable on her jaw. There was little point in fighting for control of her face. He could have hoisted her into the air with that one big hand on her jaw if he'd wished. He searched her gaze a long, silent moment.
"You truly dunna ken it, do you? Excepting with you, Jessica. You, lass, are the exception to everything," he said softly.
As if he'd not just knocked the breath out of her with those words and left her feeling weak-kneed, he released her chin, turned away, and began pushing the cart again. Jessie stood in the aisle, gaping after him. Then she broke into a sprint and caught him again. Closing a hand on his forearm, she tugged him to a stop.
"You mean you're not just stuck with me? You like me?"
She wanted to kick herself the moment she blurted the stupid question.
"Pathetic, Jessie,"
she winced inwardly.
"That was worse than the 'I carried a watermelon' line from Dirty Dancing."
His gaze was dark with some unfathomable emotion as he stared down at her. She stared, trying to determine what it was.
It was an emotion she'd seen several times before, and at the oddest moments. It was regret, she realized abruptly. A subtle, yet bottomless sorrow in those beautiful, darkly lashed eyes. But what was he regretting, and why at this moment as opposed to any other? It made no sense to her. Suddenly he smiled, and the sadness was vanquished by whiskey heat.
Aye, Jessica, I like you, and I'm not just stuck with you. You fit me here, woman.
He thumped his chest with his fist. Then he shook her hand from his forearm and pushed off with the cart again. Jesse watched him move down the aisle, all sleek animal muscle and dark grace. Wow. He wasn't a man of many words, but when he used them, he certainly used the right ones.
You fit me here. You are the exception to everything.
Criminy. It was how she'd always thought a relationship should be. People should fit each other, some days like sexy, strappy, high-heeled shoes, other days like comfortable loafers, but always a good fit. And if you cared about someone, they should be the exception to everything, the number one priority, the one who came before all others. He was halfway down the aisle from her now, plucking a can from the shelf. Her primal hunter-gatherer procuring food by modern means, she thought, with a soft snort of amusement. As she watched, he examined the can intently, read the ingredients, then returned it to the shelf and chose another, repeating his thorough study of it. The contrast between his rough, tough guy appearance and the domestic act he was performing did funny things to her head. She had a sudden, breathtaking vision of a dark-haired little boy sitting in the seat of the cart, laughing up at Kian, grabbing at his swinging braids with chubby little fists, while his daddy inspected the ingredients on a jar of baby food. Her mind's eye picture of sexy, strong man with beautiful, helpless child made something soft and warm blossom behind her chest. Just then, two women sashayed around the corner, toting baskets on their arms. They were about her age, model slim, and very pretty. When they saw Kian, their eyes widened, and they did double takes. Her soft and warm feeling popped with the abruptness of a balloon bursting. As they made their way down the aisle toward her, the nerve of them, they turned around three more times to check out his butt. His butt, like it was public property or something. Her hands fisted. A thundery little storm began to brew. Unfortunately, the women ruined the beginnings of a perfectly good brood by smiling at her and whispering in a sisterly, conspiratorial manner as they passed.
"Heads up, sweetie. Major eye candy ahead. Check it out."
As they moved into the next aisle, Jesse blew out a gusty sigh. They'd just had to be nice. Crossing her arms, she glared at Kian's butt. Did it have to be so perfect? Couldn't he have been a little shorter? Maybe he should cut his hair. No, she amended hastily, she loved his hair. It was sexy and silky, and she really wanted to see it without all those braids in once, not to mention feel it sweeping her bare skin. Something in her tummy did a flip-flop. It wasn't a comfortable feeling. It was a scary feeling. The dratted green-eyed monster had gotten her again. She felt downright possessive of him, like he was hers or something. What was happening to her? Kian turned just then and glanced back at her. His eyes narrowed. His hot gaze swept her from head to toe. He wet his lower lip, caught the tip of his tongue between his teeth, and flashed her a wicked smile. His expression could not have more clearly said,
"The moment I get through doing what must be done, I'm going to be all over you, woman."
She brightened.
"Okay,"
she said, nodding agreeably. It was looking like it might just turn out to be a banner day in Jesse St. James's world after all. He tossed his dark head back and laughed, his gilded Scotch gaze glittering with lust and unconcealed masculine triumph. He was still laughing when he disappeared. Chapter 19 Banner Day, her ass. No bones about it, she hated that mirror.
It took Jessie nearly an hour to find her way back to the SUV. Or rather, back to where the SUV had been in her other life, the one in which her possibilities for survival hadn't looked quite so grim. When they'd stormed from Tiedemann's earlier, Kian had swiftly rearranged the mirror to his satisfaction, so their new purchases might not slip and slide in transit and damage it. Then he'd turned and loped down the streets of Inverness at such a furious pace that it had been all she could do to keep up with him. She'd hardly glanced left or right, and hadn't paid any attention to where they were going, nor had she even bothered trying to gather the breath to talk to him until they'd finally stopped at the grocery store. Ergo, she'd not realized how far he'd taken her, evading his descendant, until she'd attempted to retrace her steps through the unfamiliar Scottish streets. Then, because she'd been watching for the SUV, not the store, she'd actually sprinted past Tiedemann's twice before realizing their stolen rental vehicle was no longer there.
"Shit, shit, shit!"
she cried, staring at the empty space in front of the store. She glanced farther down the street, thinking perhaps the SUV had inexplicably sprouted feet and moved itself while they'd been gone. Stranger things had happened of late. Or maybe she'd just forgotten exactly where she'd parked it on the cobbled avenue. Nope, not a single big black stolen SUV on either side of the street. How bad could one person's luck get?
"Don't answer that,"
she snapped hastily in a general upward direction. "That was a purely rhetorical question, not a show-me-proof one." She was beginning to suffer the paranoid suspicion that the universe was using her as the butt of a series of perverse jokes. The whole time she'd been winding down street after street, she'd been damning a rising tidal wave of panic, assuring herself that everything was going to be just fine, that this was only a minor setback, that Kian had just been sucked back into the mirror earlier than either of them had expected, and once she got back to the SUV, she'd drive them back to their camp, and they'd try again tomorrow, with greater success. Which wasn't to say that she hadn't been pissed when he'd vanished. She had. She'd left her purse inside her backpack in the SUV, figuring she wouldn't need it because Kian could voice her whatever she wanted, and her $42.17 certainly wasn't going to go very far. Then, when he'd so abruptly disappeared, she'd stood in the grocery with a cart full of lovely snacks, her stomach growling hungrily, and realized that she was going to have to leave all that scrumptious food because she didn't have even a few dollars stuffed in a pocket somewhere, and couldn't buy so much as a measly candy bar to get her through for a while. She'd been so hungry that she'd actually considered shoplifting. It had not been a stab of conscience that had prevented her from embarking on a larcenous spree. Hunger was a brutally compelling motive. But fear of being caught. Because then what would happen to Kian? With that worry foremost in her mind, stomach protesting her every retreating step, she'd left the grocery and dashed off to find him. Only to find this, a great big empty parking space. Where was he? She slumped down onto the curb and perched on the edge of it, propping her elbows on her knees, her chin on her fists. She couldn't believe that Lucan could have found them so quickly. If he had, wouldn't she be dead? Or at least under attack right now? She glanced hastily, warily around. No one was staring at her or moving toward her in a menacing manner. Which left only two other possibilities that she could think of. One, a thief had stolen their stolen auto, which, in addition to pushing the limits of the absurd, sucked, because for the life of her she couldn't see a way she was going to be able to track down a thief by herself, nor could she report a stolen vehicle stolen to the police, because the police were dread possibility number two. Two, the police had spotted it and impounded it, and Jessie St. James was now wanted for grand theft auto. Thanks to a half-dozen pieces of identification in her purse, in addition to being wanted for theft of the mirror, and probably all the stuff Kian had voiced from Tiedemann's, and possibly murder one, though she was really hoping deletion of the hotel records had gotten her out of that, as well as just plain dead by one evil sorcerer. She'd never been wanted for so many things in her life, and not a single one of them any good. Dagus grimaced as he tugged the dark glass from the back of the SUV. Though he had no desire to make contact with it, mostly because he had every desire to make contact with it, He wanted it in the castle proper, the most heavily warded portion of the estate. 'Twould be safest there, and he hoped mayhap those wards would diminish the pull it was exerting on him. There were no protection spells laid around the vast, detached garage behind the castle where he'd parked the purloined SUV. 'Twas too new of a building, and one of which he'd not overseen the construction. He intended to properly ward it soon, for he hoped to make much use of it. He was developing quite a liking for modern modes of transportation. They were far easier on a man's privates than a horse betwixt the thighs. He was already sorry he'd left his Hummer down in Inverness. The muscle-packed H1 Alpha was the first vehicle he'd purchased since he'd been living in the 21st century, and 'twas a truly magnificent machine. A man could go virtually anywhere in the rugged highlands in it. He'd gotten attached to it in the manner a lad did his first fine stallion. He hoped his barbaric ancestor was a responsible driver.
"Arrogant Neanderthal,"
Dagus muttered, standing the mirror up on end, at arm's length, and taking a good look at it. He inhaled a sharp, fascinated breath. The legendary dark glass in his hands. Astonishing. He traced his fingers lightly over the cool, silvery surface, then across the runes chiseled deep into the golden frame. Not even the 13 within him, who'd lived side by side with the Tuatha De many millennia ago, knew the language with which the frame was adorned. It was said that the Seelie and Unseelie Hallows had been spoken into existence by the sheer magic of the Tuatha De tongue. The sacred relics had been spelled into being by words and song, and not in the tongue of Adam Black and his contemporaries, but in a far more ancient language that had been spoken eons past, long before the Tuatha De had come to this world, a language allegedly forgotten by all but the most ancient among them. A chill was inching up his arms. 'Twas not an entirely unpleasant sensation. In fact, 'twas strangely invigorating, made him feel positively powerful. Not good. Not good at all. Scowling, he turned, hurrying with it from the garage. The moment he stepped from the cool, windowless interior into the brilliant sunshine, he felt better, stronger. Still, he wasn't about to dally with the infernal thing in his hands. Tucking the glass beneath his arm with the silvery side facing him, so as not to blind anyone who might be looking his way, he walked around the castle and began heading across the front lawn.
"You bloody fucking idiot!"
the mirror roared.
"Have you any idea what you've gone and done?"
Dagus was so startled by the bizarreness of the dark glass roaring at him that he did what most men would have done. He dropped it. Drustin lay flat on his back, his arm around his wife, breathing hard. 'Twas high noon and he was still in bed, which wasn't to say he was a lazy man and hadn't yet been up that morn. He'd been up. And up. With his lovely wee Gwendolyn in his arms, he was nigh always up.
"God, that was amazing,"
his wife said fervently just then, curling closer into his side, one of her small, dainty hands caressing his lightly stubbled jaw. He had a sudden urge to leap from the bed and proudly pound his chest with his fists. He settled instead for turning his head, kissing her palm, and saying with studied casualness,
"Mean you the third or fourth time, lass?"
She laughed.
"All times. As it has been since our first time, Drustin. You're always amazing."
"I love you, woman,"
he said fiercely, recalling their first time. 'Twas a night he'd never forget, not a detail of it, not the crimson kitten thong he'd believed a fancy hair ribbon when he'd glimpsed it in her pack, until she'd slipped her shorts down that night, showing him what it was really meant for. Not the intense way they'd made love right there in God's great wide open, beneath a star-drenched sky, in the center of the standing stones of Bandrocade. Nor the way she'd later stood, so true of heart and trusting, as he'd cast her back in time. Gwen Cassidy was his soulmate. They were bound in the ancient druid way, forever and beyond, and every moment of life with her was priceless. She'd enriched his world in so many ways, not the least of which had been the recent gift of two beautiful dark-haired twin daughters, who at scarce 5 months of age were already showing rather startling signs of intelligence. And why shouldn't they, he thought proudly, betwixt his druid gifts and his wee Gwendolyn's brilliant physicist's mind? On the topic of their babes,
"Think you we should?"
"Yes,"
she agreed instantly.
"I'm missing them, too."
He smiled. Though they'd been wed for little over a year, they knew each other's mind and heart as well as their own. And although they had the best of care for their daughters with two live-in nannies, they were reluctant to be parted from their bairn for long. Unless they were tooping, of course. Then they tended to forget the whole world. When she peeled herself from his side and moved toward the shower, he rose to join her. But as he passed the tall windows of their bedchamber, a flicker of motion beyond them caught his eye. He paused, glancing out. His brother was standing out on the lawn, gazing down at the grass. Druston's smile deepened. They'd been through a time of it when Dagus had turned dark. It had been hellish there for a while, but his brother was once again free, and by Amergen life was rich and sweet and full. His Da Sylvan and their next mother Nell would be delighted to know how well their sons fared in the modern day. He had all he'd ever wanted, a cherished wife, a burgeoning clan, his brother wed and blissfully happy, and the prospect of a long, simple, good life in his beloved Highlands. Och, there'd been a bit of a ruckus last month when one of the Tuatha De, Adam Black, had appeared, but things had swiftly settled back into an easy cadence, and he was looking forward to a long time of... He blinked. Dagus was conversing with a mirror. Standing in the middle of the front lawn, holding it gingerly by the sides, and speaking heatedly to it. Druston rubbed his jaw, perplexed. Why was his brother talking to a mirror? Was it some strange 21st-century way of mulling things over, of literally consulting with oneself? Come to think of it, he mused, where had the mirror come from? It hadn't been there moments ago. It was taller than his brother, wider, too. 'Twas hardly as if Dagus might have been concealing it in a pocket or beneath a fold in his kilt. Not that he was wearing a kilt. They'd both adopted modern modes of dress and were slowly adapting to new ways. Druston leaned against the window pane. Nay, not only was the looking-glass quite awkwardly large, it flashed brilliant gold and silver in the sun. How could he have overlooked it earlier? Mayhap, he decided, it had been lying on the ground, and Dagus had picked it up. And mayhap, he was merely saying something along the lines of, "Oh my, how peculiar, where did you come from?" Druston's silvery eyes narrowed. But why would a mirror be lying about on the front lawn? They had gardeners, surely one of them would have noticed such a thing and relegated it elsewhere. How had it gotten there? Perchance dropped from the sky? He was getting a bad feeling about this.
"Are you coming, love?"
Gwendolyn called. He heard the sound of the shower spray change as she stepped beneath it. In his mind's eye, he could see her, water sluicing down her beautiful body, glistening wetly on her smooth, pale skin. He adored modern plumbing, couldn't get enough of his wife when she was soapy and slippery and feeling frisky. Below him, Dagus was now shaking a fist and shouting at the mirror. Druston closed his eyes. After a long moment, he opened them again and cast a longing glance in the direction of the running shower and his gloriously naked, wet wife. Then a glare out the window. He exhaled gustily.
"Ah, I do not think so, love. I'm sorry,"
he called.
"But 'twould seem Dagus is, for some unfathomable reason, having a heated discourse with a looking-glass out on our front lawn."
"Dagus is doing what with a heated horse and a looking-glass?"
Gwyn exclaimed from the shower.
"Discourse, sweet. Discourse," he called back.
"Huh?"
He sighed again. Then,
"He's talking to a mirror," he called much more loudly. "I must go discover why."
"Talking to a... Oh, on the front lawn? Dagus? Really? Wait for me, Druston. I'll just be a minute,"
she yelled back.
"This sounds positively fascinating."
Druston shook his head. Fascinating, his woman said. She had the oddest perspective on things sometimes. He smiled faintly then, suddenly far less chafed by the prospect of yet another ruckus in his life. After all, wasn't that what life was about? Ruckuses. And if a man was truly blessed, he got a woman like his Gwendolyn with whom to share them.
Pick me up, you ham-fisted oaf! The bloody frigging sun is bloody frigging blinding me!
The mirror snarled. Dagus blinked down at the glass. 'Twas lying face up on the lawn and stuffed nigh to bursting with an enraged Kian McKelter. One of his ancestors' hands was braced at the side of the mirror, on the inside of the glass, the blade of his other hand to his forehead, as if shielding his narrowed eyes from a glare. For a long moment, Dagus simply couldn't find any words with which to form a sentence. Then,
"What the hell are you doing in there, kinsman?"
he managed blankly. There was a man inside a mirror, his relative, his ancient relative. He'd thought he'd seen it all, but he'd ne'er seen aught like this. Dozens of questions collided in his mind.
"Son, blinding, pick me up!"
his ancestor snapped. Dagus glanced up. The sun was directly above him. He glanced back down. Mystified, he bent and stood the glass up on end, facing him. He handled it gingerly, trying not to touch much of it. Because his grip was not firm, it slipped from his fingers and nearly went right back down again. He scarce managed to catch it in time.
"For Christ's sake, be careful with the damn thing,"
his ancestor hissed.
"'Tis made of glass, sort of, in an odd sense of the word. Are you always so clumsy?"
Dagus stiffened.
"Are you always such a foul-tempered arse? You've the manners of a blethering lowlander. 'Tis no wonder you've such a bad reputation."
"I've a bad—"
his ancestor broke off, raising his hands as if to ward off further talk on that topic.
"Forget it. I do no wish to ken what they say about me."
He glanced around the lawn.
"Where the hell have you taken me?"
"Castle Keltar."
Dagus thought a moment, then added,
"A second Castle Keltar, not the one you likely knew."
A muscle worked in his kinsman's jaw.
"And how far would this second Castle Keltar be from Inverness?"
Dagus shrugged.
"Half an hour or so."
"Let me guess, you interfering barbarian. For some reason you took my vehicle."
The mirror snapped.
"I'm a barbarian. Look who's talking,"
Dagus said indignantly.
"You bloody fool. You will go back down there and get my woman. Now."
"Your woman?
The last was with you in the store."
"I..."
Dagus shook his head slowly. This was leverage.
"Nay. Not until you tell me what's going on and explain yourself to my brother. What are you doing in the mirror? I can full well what it is. 'Tis the dark glass, an unseely hallow, and the Keltar have no business with unseely relics. How are you using it? Are you practicing black magics? My brother will not permit such doings in his keep. Druston suffers no—"
His kinsman pounded his fists on the inside of the mirror, actually rattling it in the ornate frame.
"Go get my woman. You left her unprotected, you son of a bitch."
"Nay, answers first,"
Dagus said flatly.
"Not a word until she's here,"
Kian said just as flatly. They glared at each other, at an impasse. A sudden thought occurred to Dagus. Why wasn't his temperamental, formidably gifted ancestor bursting forth from the glass and going after his woman himself? What could stop a druid as mighty as Kian McKelter?
"You're stuck in there, aren't you?"
he exclaimed.
"What the bloody hell do you think? You think I'd be sitting in here twiddling my thumbs if I could do something? Go get my woman."
"But you were out earlier. How? Why?"
"You said you had a woman of your own,"
his ancestor cut him off roughly.
How would you feel if she'd been left by herself in the middle of a city she'd never been in before, and there were trained assassins hunting her? My woman is in danger, damn you. You must go after her, man. Then I'll tell you aught you wish to ken.
A fist closed around Dagus' heart at the thought of Chloe in such a situation. He'd seen her in danger before, and it had damn near killed him. A man's woman took priority over everything else. Questions could wait. The care and well-being of loved ones could never be deferred. Never.
Oh, blether in hell, I didn't know. I'll go get your woman,
he said instantly. Tucking the mirror beneath his arm again, he hastened with it toward the castle.
We're going the wrong way!
The mirror shouted for the third time as Dagus walked up the front steps and entered the castle.
Nay, we're not. I told you I'm not taking you with me,
Dagus said flatly.
I will find your woman far more quickly if I do not have to be worrying about breaking you. I know what she looks like. I'll find her. I vow it.
'Twas truth that he didn't wish to have to be concerned about damaging the mirror, but even more truth that he didn't want to be in such close proximity to the Dark Hollow any longer. He suspected its strange pull had been working subtly on him the entire time he'd been driving home, peeking when he'd opened up the back of the SUV. He had no desire to spend what could be hours driving around with the Hollow no more than a few feet away from him, in an enclosed space. Tossing his head back, he bellowed,
Thruston!
With enough volume to rattle the eaves.
Christ, Dagus, I'm right above you,
his brother replied, wincing.
There's no need to go shouting the walls down.
Dagus glanced up. His twin was standing at the balustrade that overlooked the great hall entrance, gazing down.
How was I to know that? Why are you standing there, Drustan?
Why are you talking to a mirror, Dagus?
Drustan said very, very quietly.
I said wait for me!
Gwyn cried at that moment, from somewhere down the corridor behind his brother. Dagus shook his head. He had no time for explanations. The woman's name, Kian had told him as they'd crossed the lawn, interspersed with his increasingly pissed-off demands to accompany him back down to Inverness, was Jessica St. James. She was an innocent in this, whatever this was, and she was in mortal danger. He had to go. Now. Propping the mirror against the wall near the door, he waved a hand at it and clipped, Thruston, Kian McKelter. Kian, Thruston McKelter.
Dagus.
Drustin's voice was soft as velvet, never a good sign.
Why are you introducing me to a mirror?
Look in the mirror, Thruston.
Dagus said impatiently, angling it a bit so he could see into it from above. His brother's jaw dropped. Dagus smiled faintly. 'Twas nice to know he wasn't the only one utterly discombobulated by the sight of a man inside a mirror.
I don't believe he can get out, Thruston, so he shouldn't present a danger. However, you may wish to store him away from women and children until we know more.
Drustin was still gaping, speechless.
The mirror growled. Away from women and children? I've never been a threat to women and children, you lummox!
Verily, kinsman, we know naught about you,
Dagus retorted.
So why don't you try explaining things to my brother while I'm gone? Then, mayhap, somebody can explain them to me when I return.
Don't leave me here,
Kian hissed.
Take me with you.
I said I'll find your woman, and I will.
Above him, Drustin finally found his tongue.
Kian McKelter,
he exploded.
Mean you our ancestor, Kian? The one from the 9th century?
Aye, and 'tis the Dark Glass, Drustin, one of the Unseelie Hollows,
he imparted tersely. His brother didn't contain the vast knowledge of the Draugr within him, and Dagus doubted his ability to recognize it for what it was.
You may wish to keep your contact with it to a minimum. It works on the magic in our blood, enticing us.
He added a final aside. I inadvertently left his woman unprotected. I must go get her. I'll return as soon as I can. Without further ado, Dagus turned and raced from the castle.
Chapter 20 Jessie polished off her third hamburger, balled up the paper wrapping, and tucked it back in the bag.
Better, lass? Dagus asked.
Oh, yes,
she said with a contented sigh. She'd never tasted such scrumptious, decadently juicy, perfect hamburgers in her entire life, though she suspected not having eaten in over 24 hours might be biasing her the teeniest bit. She gulped thirstily at her supersized water. All the walking and worrying she'd done today had left her feeling dehydrated. Leaning back against the seat of the SUV, she stretched out her legs. She was feeling tremendously better, buoyed by food, heartened by the discovery that Kian was somewhere safe, and quite frankly delighted that she wasn't going to have to sleep beneath a bridge somewhere tonight, using newspapers for blankets.
Oh, Christ, have I told you how sorry I am?
Only about 100 times now, she told Dagus dryly.
"'Tis but that I feel like such an ass, lass. I'd ne'er have taken the mirror if I'd thought 'twould leave you in any danger. Please believe that.'
"'I do,'
she assured him.
"'And it's all right. Everything turned out okay. I'm here, Kian's safe, and no one's the worse for wear.'
Although, she appended silently, she wasn't going to feel 100% okay until she saw Kian with her own eyes. She glanced over at Dagus. It was full dark outside, and the only light in the SUV came from the faint green glow of the dashboard's electronics. He looked a lot like Kian in the low light. Same strong features, long hair, powerful body. His quiet respect and responsibility toward women reminded her of Kian as well. He'd been searching for her for hours, he'd told her, when they'd finally crossed each other's path. At a complete loss for what to do upon discovering the SUV missing, Jessie had commenced methodically searching every street, alley, and parking lot in Inverness, hoping against hope that she would somehow miraculously stumble upon it somewhere. It was a terrible plan, and she knew it. But she'd needed to take some action, any kind of action, to avoid having a meltdown. The truth was, she'd not really expected to find the stolen vehicle again, and near dusk, when she'd spotted it at the end of the next block, idling by the curb, she'd been flabbergasted. She sprinted eagerly, stupidly toward it the moment she'd glimpsed it. Belatedly, she'd checked herself and stopped warily 12 feet away. Then Kian's descendant had stepped from it.
"Hey!"
she'd blurted to his back, without thinking.
"I know you! What are you doing with our SUV?"
The sudden fear that he might be a bad guy, too, had spiked through her then. But he'd turned and looked at her, and his expression had been one of such pure relief that her fears vanished.
"Thank God! There you are, lass! I've been looking all over for you!"
he'd exclaimed. Exhausted and starving, she'd nearly burst into tears. She wasn't all alone and lost in Scotland with nowhere to turn after all. Someone had been looking for her. Someone was glad to see her. He'd told her, with the first of his many apologies, that he'd only taken the SUV because he'd seen the dark glass in it and been worried about what was being done with the hollow. He'd been home already when he'd discovered Kian in the mirror and been sent back by his furious ancestor to find her. His furious ancestor, he'd said. He knew, and he wasn't the least bit weirded out by it. Although Dagus had referred to Kian as kinsman in Tiedemann's, Jessie had decided that Dagus must have believed they were somehow distantly related in current day, that Kian was an illegitimate, distant cousin or something. Certainly not that he was an ancient ancestor who'd been trapped in a mirror for 11 centuries. Really, what sort of person would readily accept that kind of nonsense? She certainly hadn't. She'd resisted until the last possible moment, only when she'd been forced to concede that her life was at stake. But Dagus wasn't having any problem with it at all, which pointed to only one logical conclusion.
"So, I guess none of you McKelters are normal, huh?"
she probed. He smiled faintly.
"Nay, not exactly. I'm fair certain my wife will tell the tale better than I. But I and my twin, whom you'll meet shortly, are from the 16th century.
Jessie blinked.
"Did you turn, too? Is that how you got here?"
"Turn?"
"Into a dark sorcerer.
she clarified.
Is that how you and your brother ended up here? Did you guys get stuck in things, too?
Dagus made a choking sound.
By the sweet saints, is Kian a dark sorcerer, then, lass?
Don't you know anything about your ancestor?
His name was stricken from all Keltar annals 11 centuries ago. Verily, until just recently, when the underground chamber was reopened, we believed him a legend, not more. Is he a dark sorcerer, then?
He seems to think so. I'm not so sure.
How did he end up in the mirror?
I don't know. He won't talk about it. Yet.
She added firmly. Jessie'd had several epiphanies today while hunting for Kian, terrified that she might never see him again. The day had stretched on, and alone with her thoughts and fears, certain facts had attained a stark clarity in her mind. One was that she wanted to know everything there was to know about Kian McKelter. All of it, good and bad. She knew from the parts of his stories that had penetrated her stupor the night he'd killed the assassin masquerading as room service, that he'd had a wonderful childhood in the Highlands. She knew also that, somewhere, something had gone terribly wrong. She wanted to know what it was, how he'd ended up in the mirror, how he could think he was a dark sorcerer when every time she looked at him, she saw light. Oh, not pure, sweet, blinding light, not even close. Kian McKelter wasn't that kind of man, and would never be. Truth was, she didn't much like that kind of man anyway. Kian wasn't one of the bad guys, but he could be, if necessary, at the drop of a hat and utterly without remorse. But bad guy wasn't his primary persona. He was what psychologists and anthropologists would call an alpha male, men who were defined by an inherent lawlessness. They obeyed only their own code, and if it happened to briefly converge with the laws of society at large, it was mere coincidence. One could never be completely certain what an alpha male would do if he, or those he considered his, were threatened. One could only hope to stay within an alpha male's protected circle, or as far out of his line of sight as possible. Jessie knew where she wanted to be, smack at the center of Kian McKelter's protected circle. And not just because someone was after her, but because he wanted her there under any circumstances. That was the second epiphany she'd had today while frantically hunting for him.
But you do not think he's dark, eh, lass?
Dagus jarred her from her thoughts.
You think he's a good man. Do you believe in him, lass? With your heart.
She looked at him curiously. There was a note of urgency in his voice, as if the question was very important to him.
You don't even know me. Would it matter to you if I did?
Och, aye, Jessica. A woman's thoughts and feelings always matter to Keltar men.
With each passing moment, she was liking Keltar men more and more.
So, do you? He pressed.
Yes,
Jessie said without reservation.
I do.
When they got to the castle, criminy, she was in a castle. Dagus guided her through at such breakneck speed that her surroundings whizzed by, and she hardly managed to see a thing. She got a brief, astonished glimpse of a magnificent great hall, with a fabulous fairy tale staircase that descended from both sides of the upper stories, a rapid look at a stunning suit of armor in an alcove, and a much too hasty glance into a darkly paneled room adorned by ancient weaponry, with claymores, battle axes, spears, and broadswords gracing the walls in intriguing geometric patterns. She'd positively itched to grab a chair, pull them down, and begin testing for authenticity, though she suspected everything she was seeing was the genuine article. Why wouldn't the contents of the castle be from centuries long past? The occupants were. After steering her into a library, he deposited her there, then hurried off to
gather the rest of the clan and bring your man in. My brother and our wives will join you anon.
Now, waiting by herself, she proceeded to take a thorough, fascinated peek around. The library was a beautiful, spacious, yet cozily inviting retreat, reminding Jessie much of the understated, impeccable elegance of Professor Keene's office. Tall bay windows, draped in velvet, overlooked a manicured garden. Cherry bookcases were recessed into paneled walls. An enormous, dusky rose stone and marble fireplace climbed one wall, the elaborate mantle climbing all the way to the ceiling. There were many richly brocaded, overstuffed chairs and ottomans arranged in various conversation areas, beside lavishly carved, leather-detailed occasional tables. The tray ceiling had ornate embossing and three tiers of elegant moldings. A stately bar was custom-crafted into a section of the bookshelves. From what she'd seen on her rushed way through, the entire castle was a historian's dream, liberally scattered with antiques and relics, and the library was no different. Centuries-old tapestries adorned the walls. The room was illumined by exquisite, and she was willing to bet real, Tiffany table lamps that cast a stained glass amber and rosy glow about the room. The majority of the books on the shelves were leather-bound, and some looked quite old, resting with care on their flats, not their spines. A massive desk with a top inlaid of three gleaming burled panels divided by intricate Celtic knotwork occupied one corner, with a tall leather chair behind it. Library tables perched beneath spotlighted portraits of Keltar ancestors. Muted antique rugs warmed the room, accented by an occasional plush lambskin. A pretty ladder with sides of carved scrollwork slid along the walls of bookcases on padded wheels, atop the gleaming perimeter of wood floor. She was just moving toward the ladder, to push it to an especially interesting-looking pile of manuscripts, when two pretty blondes burst into the library, followed by a man she initially mistook for Dagus.
"Welcome to Castle Keltar," one of the blondes said breathlessly. "I'm Gwyn, and this is my husband, Drustin. This is Dagus's wife, Chloe."
"Hi," Jesse said tentatively. "I'm Jesse St. James."
"We know, Dagus told us," Gwyn said. "We can't wait to hear your story. You can start now if you'd like," she said brightly. "We've been waiting all day."
Dagus walked in then, toting the mirror, holding it by the sides. She'd half expected to hear furious bellows heralding his approach, and was somewhat surprised that the glass was silent. He crossed the room and propped the mirror up against the bookcase, near the conversation area where she and the McKeltars had gathered. She peered at it. It was flat silver, and there was no sign of Kian. Jesse hurried over to the looking-glass, reaching instinctively for it. At the same moment, Kian's hand rose within the silver, as he stepped forward, making himself visible. She heard feminine gasps behind her.
"So, there he is," one of the women exclaimed. "Not only did he refuse to answer any of our questions, he wouldn't even show himself until you got here."
The world receded around her and narrowed down to nothing but Kian. The expression in his whiskey gaze was stark.
"Ugh, Jessica,"
he said, his butter-rum voice rough and low. He was silent a moment, drinking her in.
"I'm not much of a man when I can't even protect my woman. The bloody glass reclaimed me and I couldn't get to you."
"My woman," he'd called her. She could see in his eyes and hear in his voice that the day of worrying had been hell on him, too. She was sorry it had been, and she was glad. Glad it hadn't been just her going crazy. Glad because it meant his feelings matched hers.
"Yes, you are," she told him fiercely. "You're more man than any I've ever known. You're more man than any other man could ever hope to be. You've saved my life twice. I'd be dead if it weren't for you. Besides, you couldn't possibly anticipate that your stupid descendant would steal you. Who could have seen that coming?"
Behind her, someone cleared his throat. She thought it might be Drustin, but he and Dagus were so alike that it was hard to be sure. Then she knew it was Dagus, because with a note of wry amusement in his voice, he said,
"His stupid descendant wishes to know how you release him, lass."
She pressed her other palm to the glass. Kian aligned his to hers. They stared hungrily at each other. After being afraid she'd lost him, she needed to touch him, ached to feel his body against hers, to taste his kisses, to feel his hands claiming her. His woman, he'd called her, and she was pretty sure those weren't words a ninth-century Highlander ever used lightly.
"Is it okay if I tell him?"
she asked Kian. He shrugged.
I suppose so.
She said over her shoulder,
"There's a summoning spell. Lialf, Bray, Chebre, Kian McKelter, Drachme, Seishi. But it won't work right now because..."
Even as she was about to explain that not enough time had elapsed since that morning when he'd last been out, the runes carved into the ornate frame began to blaze with a brilliant inner light, and the parameters of the library felt suddenly skewed. Her jaw dropped. Kian looked just as startled as she. Then his dark eyes blazed with exultation.
"Mayhap, because the last two times were so short, lass,"
he exclaimed hoarsely.
"Who cares the why of it?"
He pushed forward, reaching for her. One moment, Jessie had her palms pressed to cool glass. The next, it was full black and icy. And then the warm strength of his hands was closing around hers.